cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Intel is the spark for the dreamers who do. They dream of a life with no diseases, of cleaner, greener, more reliable energy, of advancing education by bringing AI everywhere. Intel is the spark to start something new, to know that no dream is too daring when you have the right foundation. It starts with Intel. Learn more at intel.com/starts.
It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
You're listening to Bloomberg Business Week with Carol Messer and Bloomberg Quick Takes' Tim Stenovic on Bloomberg Radio.
Earlier this week, U.S. stocks posted their biggest drop in 2 years. This was after the latest CPI report surprised to the upside. The silver lining, maybe it's a good time for savvy investors to buy the dip. At least that's what David Rubenstein told our Bloomberg TV colleagues the day after that massive sell-off. His comments got a lot of play online because who doesn't want investing tips from the best in the business? And luckily for us, he's back with some more tips.
David Rubenstein is founder and co-executive chairman of Carlyle Group. He's also the host of Bloomberg Wealth on Bloomberg Television. He joins us via Zoom from Washington, D.C. David, good to have you back with us this afternoon. How are you?
I'm doing fine. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, thanks so much for joining us. I want to start with the markets because I think a lot of people are spooked right now. Just give us your interpretation of what you're seeing when you look at the equity markets right now.
Clearly, the markets are not happy with the higher inflation numbers. And I think that's a big factor. When you have higher inflation, you're going to expect higher interest rates. And the Fed is next week likely to increase interest rates by 75 basis points. There are some who think it could be 100 basis points, but I doubt that that would happen. That would probably really hurt the markets much more because that would show the Fed is much more nervous about inflation than it has said it is, although it has said it's worried. But I think 100 basis points would be much more than their guidance has been. So if they were to do 100 basis points, the market would really sell off, in my view. 75 basis points, the market's already assuming that's going to happen. So probably not a big surprise to the markets. I think the news from FedEx that you were just talking about probably is going to scare people early tomorrow because when FedEx is canceling its guidance, that might mean that other companies are going to follow suit, and that might mean earnings are going to be less than people expect. So I think markets are going to be choppy for a while. There's no doubt about it.
Well, and FedEx shares right now down about 11%. Choppy, but you still think there are opportunities, especially when we see the equity side of the markets, David, sell off, that is a time to enter. You stand by that.
The greatest fortunes in the stock market are generally not made when people see a top of the market and they say, now I'm going to get in.
Fair enough.
Markets are down, and then what happens is people say, I think it could go down further, and they try to look for the bottom of the market. Anybody that's looking for the top of the market or the bottom of the market generally is on a fool's errand. So shares are off now, more than 20% from the peak, and that's a pretty good downside. It could go down a little bit more, but I don't see another 20% down. I think the markets are pretty much near the bottom. They might be 5% more to go or maybe a little bit more, but I think we know a lot of what's going on in the markets now and not likely to see big changes. Now, the Ukraine-Russia situation has had some positive news. Maybe that war could be over sooner than we once thought. And I think generally the inflation situation not under control, but the Fed seems to be on top of the situation, maybe more than it was before. So I'm not expecting we're going to see another 20% decline in stock prices.
David, and I want to get into your book in just a moment, but would you concede that it's safe to say that we really don't know kind of how things go on the other side of it, considering the pandemic that we're coming out of, the amount of stimulus that was pumped in to the global economy, that we still don't quite know? And there's still the same risks, right? We could get another variant that sets things back. China's still struggling. Geopolitical, as you said, some good news out of Ukraine, but it's still a little bit up in the air. Is it safe to say we don't quite really know how this all plays out?
This is what lawyers often call a case of first impression, which is to say we have something that's relatively unique in the sense that we haven't had $5 trillion injected into an economy quite the way the federal government did, and then know what the impact is going to be on inflation in the markets a year or two later. So we had this gigantic injection in to prevent a recession during COVID. We did prevent the recession, but we also gave us a lot of inflation. If you go back in any time in market history, you'll always find that there are problems. There's never a case where people say, you know, everything's looking great and it actually turns out to be great. It's rarely the case that you don't have challenges. Right now, we have the challenges you just discussed, plus, you know, the challenges of getting people back to work, the challenges of avoiding another COVID-type pandemic, the challenge of the U.S.-China relationship, the challenge of the Russian situation, the energy situation, many challenges, but that's what makes great market, great investors great. They can see through the challenges and get in when they when the going is good, and other people think it's bad. But now it's probably not a bad time to begin investing.
Hey, David, is there any concern? Do you have any concern that the Fed could overdo it because monetary policy, it takes a while to take effect in the economy? We're still getting some pretty hot numbers when it comes to jobs, but and inflation's still high, of course. But are you concerned that the Fed just goes too hard when it comes to interest rates?
Well, of course, the Fed did make a mistake that it admitted. It thought inflation was going to be transitory. It obviously was not. Jay Powell, who used to work at my firm, and I've known him for a long time, though I'm obviously not getting inside information from him now, I think he's a very cautious person. He likes to tell you what he's going to do, and he likes to then do it. He's pretty much said, FOMC is going to go up by 75 basis points. I think if they were going to go 100 basis points or more, I think they would have tipped the markets a bit because, as I said earlier, 100 basis points or more now would shock the markets. And I think it would be something that would see a big sell-off in stocks. So I don't see that being tipped from the Fed. And obviously, he doesn't control what the FOMC does, but he has an enormous amount of influence. So I suspect will be something around 75 basis points. The real change is whether we will have another 50 basis points increase for the remainder of the year, which is what the markets have assumed, or could it be the case that we get more than 50 basis points over the remainder of the year? And then, of course, right now the markets are generally assuming probably not any real increases early next year, and who knows, that could change. But right now, I think the markets really want some good inflation numbers. The next time some inflation numbers come out, hopefully they're better than the ones we just saw.
Do you find it, okay, and we promised we're going to get to your book, but is it wacky that we have such a strong labor market and yet, David, you know, that we constantly talk about recession?
Let me talk about the labor market.
Okay.
The unemployment rate is a misleading number in many respects. It's the one we all know. And right now the number is, I think, 3.7%. It went as low as 3.5%. And that's as low as anything I can recall. But that doesn't take into account how many people are looking for jobs. The amount of people in the labor force is less than it used to be. And remember, unemployment rate is the number of people in the previous month who are in the labor force and looking for jobs and can't find them. Mm-hmm. The labor force is actually smaller than it would be ideal. And so there probably are, you know, more people who would like jobs but don't think they can find them at the salary they want or the kind of style work style they want. So I think it is hard to believe that the unemployment rate is so low when, you know, I do know people that are still looking for jobs. And I think that, you know, we should recognize that generally an adult population, you have about 66% of working population in adult population who are in the workforce. Now that number is probably closer to 62 or 63%. So we have more people who could work, but they've taken themselves out of the workforce. And that's why the unemployment rate is so low.
All right. So let's talk about the book, How to Invest, Masters on the Craft. And I do wonder, you know, David, generally successful investors, I would argue that are successful, it's because of their differences. They find opportunities where others do not. So at the same time, I wonder, is there something that successful investors all have in common?
Yes, they have these things in common. They tend to come from blue collar and middle class families. They don't come from very wealthy families. They tend to be pretty good students. These are not typically college dropouts or high school dropouts, as a general rule of thumb. They tend to be pretty good in math. They tend to like to make decisions. They tend not like to delegate. They tend to be people who will defy conventional wisdom. The conventional wisdom say now is not the time to invest. That's when they invest. They also tend to be relatively humble because they've made a lot of mistakes over the years. Every investor does. They also tend to get rid of their mistakes pretty quickly. A really good investor, when he or she makes a mistake, they don't labor over it for months and months and months and stew about it. They get out of the position and they go on to the next thing. They also tend to be, I'd say, relatively philanthropic. Clearly, if you're in the business world and you're an investor as opposed to being in the endowment world or a nonprofit world, you tend to make a lot of money as investors, and they tend to give away a large percentage of it. So I generally, these are people who are quite articulate, quite smart, and quite hardworking. Hard work is not a problem for them because what they do is what they love. Investing is not for them work. It's pleasure. And once they've made whatever they need to make, $1 billion, $2 billion, $10 billion, $20 billion, they don't stop working. They work until they, you know, just can't do it anymore. They don't tend to retire at 55 or 60.
Some of the names on here, I mean, this is a who's who of the Wall Street world and also Silicon Valley when it comes to alternatives. I mean, we're talking people like Larry Fink, John Gray, Sam Zell are featured in here. Ray Dalio when it comes to hedge funds. We got John Paulson on hedge funds, Mark Andreessen when it comes to venture capital. I want to go back to what you said about mistakes, though, because I think this is something that doesn't get enough attention, because a lot of people look at these folks as people who've just been so successful. And, you know, the mistakes aren't really what's written about. What are some prominent mistakes that you learned about when you were doing reporting for this book?
Well, of course, every investor has his or her stories of their mistakes. And I wouldn't put myself in the great investor category, but I turned down Facebook when Mark Zuckerberg was in college. I told Jeff Bezos his company wasn't going to get anywhere, and I sold his stock relatively early, right at the IPO. When Mark Andreessen came to my firm to try to raise money at the beginning for Netscape, I told him it would never get anywhere. So I've, you know, made a lot of mistakes myself. I think every investor makes mistakes, and that's what life is all about. So every one of these investors will tell you about one mistake they've made or another, and I could go through each of those investors and tell some of the mistakes that they told me they make. But, you know, in the end, they get over it quickly. I tend to be a person that likes to talk about my mistakes 30 years later. They don't do that. They tend to go on to the next thing. And that's one of the reasons they're great investors. They can clear their mind of their mistakes.
Well, you know, one thing I found among the investors that you talk to, I always think about Sam Zell a lot in terms of when he sold his REIT at the height and just before everything came undone from the great financial crisis, right, and the housing meltdown. And I do wonder, is there a lesson there in terms of who were, you know, was he just super smart, lucky timing? Like, what is it?
You know, really smart people tend to have better luck than not people who are, than people who are not so smart.
Yeah.
So in Sam Zell's case, he's really smart. He wasn't really looking to sell his company. He got an offer and then he was willing to accept that offer. And then another offer came at a higher price. He kind of ran an auction. And he wasn't intending to, but it shows you he makes mistakes too, because he got a higher price than he ever expected and a higher price than he would have had he not run a little auction. The profits that are above the price he initially accepted was a large sum of money he made. He took that money and bought the Chicago Tribune and it went bankrupt. Mm-hmm. So he quickly learned that running a newspaper is not as easy as running an office building.
I'm trying to think of, the average investor out there, people who are listening to our show, people who have Bloomberg terminals, who are, you know, making their own personal investments, and even beyond those people, David, and I'm wondering what lessons they can take away from listening to the pros.
The most common mistake that investors make, the pros would say, and I think I'm talking about average investors. In other words, the book is not designed to make you into Sam Zell or John Gray. That's unrealistic. No book is going to do that. But it's designed for people who are average investors who dabble in the market, or they buy funds and they have other people dabbling for them, in effect. I would say that the most common mistake that people point out to me is that people, when the markets are going up, they rush in and they want to catch it at the top. And then when the markets are going down, they want to sell. And even a brilliant person like Sir Isaac Newton, considered at the time the smartest man in the world, the discoverer of gravity and a whole variety of other things, He invested in a South Sea Corporation publicly traded stock company, and he got out and made a big profit. And he said, you know, I'm smart in other things, not just physics. But then the market kept going up and up and up. He said, uh-oh, maybe I missed the top. He put all of his money and borrowed money to go back in, and the company went bankrupt. So he went bankrupt too. So here's a guy who's one of the smartest men in the world, but he got caught up in the temptation of seeing other people making money when he wasn't making it. So you got to be very careful, and I think know what you're doing. Also, one of the advantages of being a value investor and a long-term investor, as Warren Buffett is, they tend not to sell a lot. And when you sell a lot or you buy a lot, you have a lot of transaction costs and you have to pay taxes. One of the things that Warren Buffett has done in over 60 years, he's compounded at 20% a year for 60 years. Nobody's ever done that before, is he doesn't sell very many things. Therefore, he doesn't have transaction costs, fees, but he also doesn't pay taxes in the sense that he's not having capital gains taxes because the stock's going up and he's not selling. And that's an important thing. People should hold on to things for quite a bit longer than they tend to.
Well, and I think that's an interesting thing to say. And here I am watching shares of, I want to go back to that headline of FedEx. It's down about 12% in the after hours after the company withdrew its fiscal year 2023 earnings forecast. And it's also taking down shares of UPS in the after hours, which are now down about 6%. I mean, things like this, David, you know, we try to glean so much from it of what it's telling us about the economy. We start off our conversation talking about this. But I mean, how do investors, you know, have to think about things when they're seeing maybe a position that they are going down 12, 13% here in the after hours? You know, how do you figure out, is this still something I hold on to or is this something I sell?
Let me ask you this. If Warren Buffett was a shareholder in FedEx, I don't know if he is.
Yeah.
Do you think he's going to wake up tomorrow morning and sell that stock?
Nope. No.
And the answer is no, because he likes to buy great companies and stick with them through thick and thin. They generally that'll work out, as he proved in a lot of companies. His biggest holding now is Apple, which he bought was much lower price than it is today. You don't know whether the FedEx removal of guidance is because there's some exogenous thing that's unique to FedEx, or it just reflects the fact that there's not much shipping going on because there's not much economic buying, and not many things are being bought and shipped and so forth. You just don't know until you see what the reason is for the withdrawing the guidance. That's a big drop, though, 12%. That's for sure a big drop. But I just don't know yet what the reason is.
And let me be fair to you and our audience. The CEO of FedEx saying global volumes declined as macroeconomic trends significantly worsened later in the quarter, both internationally and the U.S. We are swiftly addressing those headwinds, but given the speed at which conditions shifted, first quarter results are below our expectations. There's a little bit of color. How does that make you think about something like this? Yeah.
Well, they emphasize the word global, so maybe the global economic problem is outside the United States more than in the United States. And there's no doubt that Europe is on the precipice of a recession because of the high energy prices, high inflation, high interest rates, and the whole war in Ukraine and the impact on the supply chain in Western Europe. So it could be that's part of the problem. And obviously, Chinese economy has slowed down, and that could be part of the problem as well. I'd be surprised if the problem is only because of the United States. I don't think that's probably the case. The U.S. economy is it's chugging along okay. We're not in a recession. We may or may not go in one, but we're clearly not in.
This episode is brought to you by EY. How can EY teams help you create a better version of your company? We work with you to turn data into greater insights, invest to drive growth, and realize your strategic vision through thoughtful implementation. Visit ey.com/reimagine to learn more.
Hi, I'm Ron Kraszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
One right now.
We're speaking with David Rubenstein, the founder and co-executive chairman of Carlyle Group. He's also the host of Bloomberg Wealth on Bloomberg Television, author of the brand new book, How to Invest, Masters on the Craft. David, the people you spoke with, really interesting names there. I want to go to Mike Novogratz.
Wait, can I just say, though, David, there's a lot of men. There's a lot of men.
Well, there's a lot of women, too. I would say, obviously, it's easy to do a book like that and fill it with old white men. I tried hard not to do that. I have in there, for example, Kim Liu, who is the woman that runs the endowment for Columbia University, a really impressive investor. Also is in there Paula Belen, who runs the endowment for Rockefeller University, Sandra Horback, who's the most senior woman in the entire private equity world. She's at Carlyle. So I would say what I tried to show is that there are women and minorities who are moving up into the pantheon of great investors. But let's be honest, today there are more white male people who are considered great investors than women, rightly or wrongly. That may change in time. And in part, what I wanted to do is inspire people who are not white males to go into this business and see that you can become Paula Belen or Kim Liu or African-American that's in there, John Rogers, who built the largest African-American investment firm in the country, Ariel Capital.
Right. We've talked with John, yeah.
Can I talk about crypto?
Yes, you can. Sorry.
Okay, thank you. All right, that's I want to ask David about crypto because, you know, in the alternative section, Mike Novogratzin, who's a name very familiar to our audience, but also somebody who has, you know, dabbled just in traditional finance, TradFi as it's known, and also in DeFi with when it comes to crypto. Your thoughts after interviewing him for this book and about whether or not crypto actually has staying power, because he did make a lot of money and also recently lost a lot of money when it comes to crypto.
Yes, well, overall, he's ahead. He bought Bitcoin when it was very, very, very cheap. And now while it's below, more than half below its peak, it's still well above what he paid for it. So he still, you know, has, I think, billions of dollars of Bitcoin. And I think he's doing okay. When I interviewed him, the market was a little bit higher for crypto. So I recognized the markets come down. But my own view on crypto, and I don't own cryptocurrencies myself, I have invested in companies that service the industry, because I think the industry is going to be around for quite a while. The people that buy crypto tend to be younger people. You don't see a lot of 70 and 80 year old white men running out and buying cryptocurrencies. You tend to see a lot of 20 year old and 30 year old people buying it, or even teenagers buying it. I interviewed for my Bloomberg TV show the other day, Sam Bankman-Fried.
Oh yeah. Mm-hmm.
He was 30 years old, worth at the peak, $22 billion. I think it's down by more than half now because crypto's come down. He built FTX, which is a big trading platform for crypto. And his view is my view as well, is that you tend to find investment trends started by younger people. And crypto is one that younger people have started. And I think they like it in part because they can trade it frequently, of course, but it has fluctuations, which makes them think they're going to make money and they're willing to take the risk about it going down. But also the privacy associated with it. You don't depend on nobody else knows what you really own. The government can't take it away from you. I think a lot of wealthy people around the world saw what happened to the Russian oligarchs, and they're saying maybe I should put some of my money in something the government doesn't know I have, can't take it away. And there's no doubt some people who are trying to maybe avoid taxes and therefore they don't report what they own. There's a lot of reasons people are going to buy crypto. And I also think the people that are buying it to a large extent are, they tend to be very libertarian in many ways. They want to be counter to the government and they've lobbied Congress. And I've had a lot of, there are a lot of members of Congress who are Republicans. We're listening to what they're saying, and I think it's unlikely you're going to see a lot of over-regulation from the Congress of the United States or over-legislation on the crypto industry.
Do you own crypto, David?
I own companies or investments in companies that service the industry, like Paxos or others. But I haven't bought currencies myself, though in hindsight I wish I had in some respects. And I tell people initially, if when you go to Las Vegas and you gamble, if you're reasonably intelligent, you know you're going to lose money. But you say, I'm having a good time. I don't mind gambling and losing money because I've allocated a small amount of money for it. And so if you can lose 1%, 2%, or 3% in Las Vegas, you can allocate the same amount of money to crypto. And if you lose it, you know, you've had the pleasure of owning it and talking about it and so forth. But if you start putting 50% of your net worth in, that could be more dangerous for sure.
Well, David, we really do always appreciate all the time that you give us. And so appreciate you also weighing in on some of the day's news. David Rubenstein, How to Invest, his latest book, Masters on the Craft. David, of course, founder and co-executive chairman of Carlyle Group, host of Bloomberg Wealth on Bloomberg TV. Great read. And as he said, there's a diversity of voices within his book talking about investment theories and ideas and what they have learned in terms of their craft, their investing craft.
The Bloomberg Sustainable Business Summit returns to London on April 25th for a solutions-driven look at the sustainable business and finance landscape, looking at the latest trends in ESG regulations, supply chain innovation and transition finance. Speakers include leaders from CDP, Emirates Environment Group, Seedtrace, COA and more. Summit advisors include City Commercial Bank, Red Sea Global and Schneider Electric. visit bloomberglive.com/sbs2024 to learn more.